Morning, everybody. How are you? Doing all right? Everybody likes to clap anymore. Well, all right, we can clap. I think I can tell you're doing all right just by looking. Wake up! No, nobody's asleep back there. I better put this on. I guess this is, I didn't ask. It's working and we're all set. I tend to roam a little bit, so, you know, if you see me in the back of the room, head me in the right direction. Mr. Patton introduced me as a minister from Salt Lake City. Now, when he said that, what did most of you think? You thought I was a Mormon. Well, I do have some long underwear on, if that'll help. I say that in jesting just a little bit, because if you're not familiar with the Mormon belief, that the devout Mormons do wear, it is holy garments, that they call it. Just thinking about, you know, I don't know if the women wear it, though. Chris, do you know if the women wear it? The reason why I know that the men wear it is because every once in a while I play a little racquetball or whatever, and so you end up in an environment where, you know, you have to get dressed. And so they're over there putting on, you know, here it is 90 degrees outside, and they're putting on this underwear. I'm amazed. But I don't know if the ladies put it on or not. Do we have any ex-lady Mormons here? It's probably because of the priesthood, and to leave the women are left out again. Boy, too bad. But it's nice to be here, but next time you think of Salt Lake City, just do us all a favor and don't think of Mormons first. Think of the Church of God International, because we do have a church there, of which I'm not the pastor. I still pastor the Denver congregation, living in Salt Lake because my job just recently transferred me there. And I try to fly over about every 4 weeks, because one of the requirements of a charter is that a local church has to have or should have a minister in attendance about once a month. So maybe that'll change with ordinations down the line or somebody else moving in. If Mr. Cormody would move down here, that would solve the problem. I think he'd make a good Mormon. Don't you think, Mr.? Move, go to Salt Lake, travel over, whatever. I have a list of people I'm supposed to say hello to here. I don't know if all you folks are here or not. See, since they knew I was coming up here from Gulf Shores and now I get to go back, I'm going to take a mailbag back with me and drop it off and say hello. But there's supposed to be, I better do my duty here. Is it Al Spock from Pine Hill, New Jersey, is supposed to be here. Mr. Al Billington is supposed to be here. There he is. Howdy, how you doing? All right, good. Then Mr. Cormody, of course, we can't miss him. He's here. Hi. And Mr. Carruthers is supposed to be here. I saw him yesterday. I'm supposed to say hello to him. And Larry Evans. Hi, Mr. Evans, how are you? These people are all from the Illinois, New Jersey area up there. And Doris Harris might be here. Now, this is one, I've got to meet this fellow just because of his name. I don't know if I'll pronounce it correctly. It's Topper Lestikin. All right, how is that pronounced? Lestition. He's not a physician, he's a Lestition. Okay. And he's a Topper Lestition on top of that. However, in looking at the name here, it's Topper, and it looks like, is Topper the woman's name? Topper is his wife's name, because it looks like Topper and Joe. So Topper's the wife. I'll wake up here in a minute, all right. And then we have Mr. Wallace. It says here, Magnum. Is that Mr., that's who we just saw, wasn't it, Mr. Magnum? That was really Mangum, I believe. What, Mr. Mangum? I was thinking about his name. I wonder why his name is Mangum. You thought about that? You know, I get interested in names sometimes, like mine is, you know, my name is Gross. And I'm known as a Gross Mormon. But Mangum, I wonder where that came from. You know, if he keeps those glasses on, I'm going to call him Mr. Raider once. Yeah, there you go. I tell you. He took his glasses off. Now he looks like Thomas Magnum. No. Those glasses do tend to make you just a tad like a man we used to know and hate. I mean, we used to know and... But anyway, hello to you, Mr. Mangum. Oh, boy, it's a lot of fun to come to the feast, and see everybody again. It tears at my heartstrings just a tad to be here because whichever direction we're looking at here, not too far away is a congregation I used to pastor called Asheville, and a little bit closer was Marion. We had a church people there that I'd sure like to see them again and probably will one day. But driving up in these beautiful Smoky Mountains brings back all sorts of memories, especially these little windy, twisty roads that you get on, you know. And these roads here are very precipitous, and all the roads in North Carolina are not this way. All the ones in Tennessee are. But these are not. I believe that there's another community west of here where the road is just as precipitous and goes up to a little town called Little Switzerland, is it? Is that out in there? I believe just a gorgeous little community and a beautiful overlook. Although I don't know, I haven't seen the flatland yet. It's been clouded in since I've been here, so I really don't know what it looks like down there. Is it raining down there in the flatlands or is it clear? Mr. Fritz was down there. There's nothing down there, huh? No rain, no sun, no, just nothing. Just a little bit like Arkansas. Yeah. Now, listening to Mr. Fritz yesterday, I would love to see where he lives. Wouldn't you like to travel go back home with Mr. and Mrs. Fritz? I'm assuming that's Mrs. Fritz. If not, let's tell his wife. But, okay, you're alone? Oh, come along, all right. But listening to you talk about Arkansas, I just love to see where you live. It sounds a little bit like where I grew up over here in Tennessee, but all those people in that bowl of catfish and all those bass, I tell you. Did he tell us whether he ate the catfish or not? No, you didn't eat the catfish, did you? Arkansas is awfully pretty. How many of you have ever been back to that part of the country to know what it's like? And it's just gorgeous. I think isn't it a lot like this, only you don't have the big mountains. How many of you have ever been back to farther west to the Rockies? All right, I just taking a little survey. It won't hurt my feelings at all. How many of you like this part of the country better than you do the Rockies? How many like the Rockies better? Well, at least half the congregation is converted. I didn't say which half. I did not say which half, and I'm not going to get involved in that. It could be the half here or the half there, right? Okay. Let's see if I have any more little notes I need to tell you about before I get started in my sermon here today. I thought I might just mention very quickly about Gulf Shores being down there. Ted didn't really describe the weather, but it was awfully nice, especially when he arrived. When I arrived, we had one day just beautiful weather. The waves were not very large, and it was nice to walk in. I'm not very excited about swimming down there. I used to swim in the ocean all the time. In fact, as a child growing up in the church, we used to go over here to Jekyll Island and plunge in and all that. But then there was a movie that came out. You remember that movie? I should never have seen that movie. Never have seen it, because when I got out on the shore there, the first thing I thought of as we were walking along barefooted in the shore, or in the waves, you know what I was thinking of? Dun, 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 dun. I looked out there, and I was really conscious of it because a little bit earlier that day, I had seen these porpoises, in the dorsal fins. I knew there were porpoises out there, and I figured if there were porpoise out there, that there might be sharks, too. So the congregation as a whole is supposed to be going out, about 80 to 100 people today down there to go deep sea fishing. And what they did is they moved the service, canceled the morning service and moved it to the evening. So it gave them the whole day for a full activity. And they're all going to go out on a large chartered boat and do some deep sea fishing today if the weather's permitting. But I don't know if it'll permit that or not. The problem with deep sea fishing is, if you've ever done it, you know what I'm talking about. If you're not used to rocking on a boat for 8 hours, when you get back on the shore, guess what you're still doing? You're sitting there rocking around, bobbing back and forth, and it goes on and on. You'll actually get ill. I know when I was out there doing it, this was several years ago, I didn't get ill from being on the boat. I got ill from being on land. When I got back on land, I was still moving, and everything else was just stationary. And I sat there, and I closed my eyes, and I was still moving. Went to bed, and I was still moving. So the way to get around that, I guess, is to take a little, what do they call it, a Dramamine pill, which is apparently supposed to, it's a trade-off of evils. A Dramamine pill versus being sick, miserably sick, for a long period of time. So tomorrow morning, since they're going fishing today, can you imagine in the congregation how many lies are going to be told? So, can you imagine tomorrow morning? I'm not talking about, bad lies. I'm talking about exaggerations, you know. Boy, did I catch a big one, you know. Or I caught 20, threw 19 back, only brought one home. You know, you can just well imagine what's going to be said tomorrow morning. But I've got a fishing story I told them I was going to save for them that I hope will top anything. And this one's the truth, too. But I'm not going to tell it to you because we're not going fishing. I've got some other things to tell you here. Well, no, I better say it. Fishing has nothing to do with my message today. Not a thing on here about fishing, but maybe I'll save it for next year. Next year in the Bahamas. Wouldn't that be nice? I've always dreamed of having the Feast of Tabernacles on a cruise ship. Wouldn't that be nice? In the Mediterranean. Should have known Mr. Patton would put us in the Mediterranean. All right. That way we could be hijacked and kidnapped and hostage and everything else. Keep it interesting. All right. Well, it certainly is nice to have a beautiful feast site like this. It's just gorgeous. And there's so many other places over the years that I've been that just not even compared to the beauty that's here. I just hope that the sun... Has the sun shone here yet? It has, so it was pretty. I was thinking that... Have you ever heard the expression, oh, what a difference... can you fill in the line for... Oh, what a difference... day makes. And I was thinking about that. If the sun would just come out for a full day and it was be, you know, we'd all wake up and say, boy, what a difference a day makes. I feel better and the sun warms me and all that kind of thing. And it's really true that a day does make quite a bit of difference depending upon what you're looking for. But I've got another thought I want to throw at you this morning, and that is this. Change the word day and let's substitute something else. Let's substitute feast. Oh, what a difference a feast makes. You ever thought about that? Because when we talk about this expression, oh, what a difference a day makes, it means that something probably has come about or something has changed that makes you wake up on a given morning or whatever the circumstance might be, and all of a sudden you recognize that this day makes a difference. You feel different, all right? Well, that's the way I feel a little bit about the Feast of Tabernacles from year to year. I remember last year up in Gunnersville how gorgeous and beautiful it was and the spirit of camaraderie and all the fun we had together. And I came away from that and I said to myself, oh, what a difference a feast makes. And I hope that we can all say that by the time that the feast is through here, going back home, you're reminded of it, to be able to recall the memory, oh, what a difference a feast makes. Because we've all gathered together from who knows where, from all different parts of the country, and we are convened together for the purpose of rejoicing during these wonderful days and having all the food we want, and more than we want, perhaps, and adequate drink, especially if you go down to Boone, apparently. You can get plenty of food down there or wherever you go. Oh, what a difference a feast makes. But you know, there are some people that come to the feast and it doesn't make any difference. Have you ever noticed that? And that saddens me just a trifle bit. That some people come to the feast, go home from the feast, and they don't have that feeling. Oh, what a difference a feast makes. I'd like to talk to us today about what we're here for, and whether or not this Feast of Tabernacles, even though it's just about, what, middleway through now, whether or not this feast is going to be one of those that will look back, and even though it may have its problems in the clouds, and maybe some of the activities get rained out, or whatever it might be, I want all of us to be able to go home and perhaps inside say, you know, the feast did make a difference. It provided me, or us, my family, with something that if I hadn't have gone, I would not have experienced. The opportunity to see people we've never seen before, opportunity to laugh together, eat together, maybe cry together, whatever you might be talking about with tears of joy, or whatever it might be. Right? We've come a long way. We've come here to worship God at the Feast of Tabernacles. And it's fun coming here. I know on the travel over, coming from Salt Lake City, I had my daughters, and... is a long trip, and what do they call these airlines that you get on, and you know you stop at every city, a mail route type thing. Is it a milk run? A milk run. That's what it was. We were on a milk run. It seemed like every little town that we stopped at, we had to land and wait a while. So by the time we got over here to Shreveport, and then after I think it was Mobile, wherever it was out there, my daughters were fairly restless, and the plane was virtually empty. And as would be expected, the stewardesses were looking for people to chat with. And here are my little girls, and being as cute as they are, irresistible. Next thing you know, there's a conversation going on. And my oldest one now is 10 years old. She's learned that there might be better ways to say things. And that way you save yourself a lot of discussion. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you don't go to what might it be? You don't go to a Baptist convention and tell people you don't drink, or you do drink. You tell them you don't drink. You know, there's certain ways or things to say things. And so what was happening is they got in the back of the plane and everybody was up walking around, and this stewardess was very friendly, and she was saying, "Well, where are you going?" And I knew my oldest daughter wanted to chime in and say something, but she didn't. She kept her mouth shut. But my little one, she said, "We're going to the feast." And I'm thinking, oh, no, you know, I don't have time to explain this, you know, going to the feast. Now, the stewardess had a very, I liked her response. She said, big smile on her face, she said, "Well, you know, I like feast too." And I didn't know if she was going our way or what was going on. And I came back there and I said, "Yeah, we're going down the Gulf Shores and all this type of thing." Now, let me tell you something which I wish I could have done, if you understand the way I mean this. Knowing that she really didn't understand where we were going, I believe that if I could have taken her with us for 7 days, you try our religion for 1 week, and I'll bet you that she would have liked it. Do you think so? I think she would have loved it. I remember reading a book, actually a story about a lady who was fairly obnoxious. She would come in, she had all of her habits, and not just ladies are this way, men are this way too, but this was a story about a lady, all right? She was just an obnoxious lady. She was grouchy, irritable, easily upset, you know, doing all the things that so many of us do routinely. And she decided, because she wasn't very well received by people, that she would change. And so she was reading a book one day about religion. And the book said, "Try going one day, just one day, not two, not three, but one day without jealousy, without lying, without stealing, smiling, all these kind of things." And she said, "Well, what do I have to lose? I've already lost everything. I don't have any friends or anything, so I'll give it a try." So she did. She came to work that morning, and she came with a smile. And the next thing you know, she went and got coffee for people. And she even gave up smoking. And things were happening where she would normally have lost her temper, and she just didn't. And of course, everybody thought she was sick. They didn't know what was wrong with her. And everybody said, "Well, what's wrong with so-and-so? And is she not feeling well today, or what's going on?" And so the story got around that the reason why she was different is because she had tried religion for one day. And everybody knew that it dramatically changed her life. And not only did she try it for one day, she tried it for 2 days, for 3 days, a week, a month, and made it a part of her life. She became a different person. Now, one of the obstacles to people joining in to our religion is they think that there's a lot going on here that really isn't. You know, all that's really going on with our group is that we're having a good time. And I don't know of anybody who doesn't like to have a good time. I think it's wonderful to have a good time. So if we could get people to try our religion, and I mean, don't eat catfish, don't eat lobster, and all those kinds. I mean, there's so many other good things to eat. But just try our religion for one day. Guess what I think? I think they're going to like it. Now, one of these days, that's the way it's going to be. But, of course, the big obstacles to liking our way of life are going to be universal then. The reason why people don't like what we do is because we keep Saturday, and we keep non-Christian days, that type of thing. So, if people can, one of these days, realize that everybody else is doing what's right and pleasing God, I think people are going to like it. Now, some are not, they're going to reject it and all that. But I think the majority are going to like it. I certainly hope the majority of my hillbillies, my ancestors, are going to like it. You know, I'm sure they will. We have gathered together from all over. By the way, who's come the farthest? I wanted to ask that. Who has come the farthest? I don't mean spiritually, but I just mean... we have one from where? One from California. Will the one person with a suntan stand up? Is that person here? The one person from California? He went to California. He's probably not here today. No one here from Canada? Well, isn't Canada farther than California? No, I guess. Are you from northern Canada? You're from southern Canada. No good. Won't work. Nobody here from British Columbia? There is somebody from Salt Lake. Salt Lake's not as far away as, you know, people in Salt Lake are still okay. People in California, it's another world. We've come a good ways. Well, let me tell you what I've experienced so far, at least because, you know, I'm gainfully employed, at least I hope, until I go back home and find I'm fired. But I'm gainfully employed. And to get away and go to Gulf Shores or come here, you know what I find myself doing? I find myself catching my breath. I mean, in a spiritual sense. An opportunity to get away from the world and the environment and just... and relax. I know this morning I got up and my room was a little bit chilly and I just got the old blanket out and went and laid on the couch and turned on the news and just laid there. And I was wide awake and I thought, boy, this is nice. This is really nice. And I went out and looked outside and saw the fog and I thought, oh, this is okay. It's really nice. And we gather together, all of us, from wherever we have come, and we really do try to catch our breath, if you will, from the routine of living week to week and making a living or battling with relatives or whatever it might be. Now, this past year has been a very difficult year for me in many respects, and I'm sure it has been for you too. With moving, my grandfather died. Just recently we buried him. And I feel like if there was some way that I could see how much this last year has battered me, maybe I could get a sense of growth. Now, how many of you parents have ever done this with your children? Have you ever used that old way of... measuring growth, taking your kids when they're little gals or guys and taking them into a closet or some place that's not necessarily noticed. And what you do is you say, back up there, and you take, I don't know what you take, but you take something and you mark it. You know, here they are, April the 16th, 1985. Susie is 3 feet, 2 inches high. You know, and then you get your other ones and you all line it up and you put your names on there, right? How many of you have ever done that? Isn't that fun? I've not done that yet. I don't know why I haven't. When I moved from Denver to Salt Lake, I tried a little novel approach. I decided to take some trees from little seedlings and bring them to Salt Lake and plant them and let them grow up. From the Salt Lake, and unfortunately, all of them died except one. The one, you know, competition among the girls, they both want that to be their tree. And I finally said, "No, the only Tanya, that's my oldest one. That's her tree." And my little one, you know, lip. Just, you know, lips, you know how little girls' lips do? They come clear out to here when they're puckering and pouting. Her lip threw out there. Said, "Daddy, won't you get me a cherry tree?" "Yeah, I'll get you a cherry tree." So we've got to get her one. But I was thinking about if there was some way that I could measure or perceive the growth that all of us have gone through this last year. I know we can't really see it, but I know that's happened. We're forced to grow. How much, I don't know. If we had it benchmarked here, some of us probably grew 2 inches and maybe some a foot. Who knows how much we've all grown. But I know that it's a necessary part of being a part of this church and the trials that we have to endure. We gather here together then with all this background to catch our breath and to relax during the feast, to have what is genuinely called a rest. Now, there is today in our society a resurgent popularity in prepackaging your destiny. You know, to try to tell you what your destiny is going to be. I recently read an article about Shirley MacLaine. Any of you see that? Where Shirley MacLaine was talking about all the things she had been. She believes in reincarnation. And so she believed that she had been inside years ago of a little Indian boy riding on an elephant, if memory serves me correctly. And then she had been inside of a woman who was involved in voodoo. And then she was inside, you know, all these different things that she was inside of. Well, listen, I've got news for her. You know, she wouldn't believe me right now, but one of these days, she's going to learn not only what her past was, that she wasn't any of that, but that she's got a destiny that all of us share in common as a part of the knowledge that we cherish. Did you all read this article? Someone handed it to me, but I knew the story. About that gentleman who survived that earthquake in... Mexico City. I mean, there were many who did, but you read the story about the fellow who had been buried for 4 days and was finally rescued. I won't read you how he survived because it just turns my stomach. I just can't believe it. I don't even know how he thought of those things to keep alive, but he did. But the thing that struck me is we like to somehow or another attribute God to our destiny, to our past, to tragedy, to blessing. We seem to put God everywhere. And today I'd like to give God a little bit of victory. We all permit us to do that. I'm getting tired of God taking it on the chin. You know what I mean by that? This man said this. I'm not quoting verbatim, but it's pretty close. He said this. He was buried for 4 days beneath all that rubble. And when they finally pulled him out, he made the comment that God saved him. But then, and I like that part of the statement, but the rest of it was, but if God had really liked me, He would have saved me on the first day. You see, he was rescued on the fourth day. And I didn't like that comment. Do you like that comment? Why didn't the man just say, I'm thankful to be alive, praise be to God, and forget if God would really have liked me, He would have rescued me on the fourth day. Let's today take a look at what God has for all of us as a never-ending story. A story that's not giving anything to God on the chin, if you know what I mean by that. But let's just take a look at what God has in store for you and for your children and for mankind, destiny of mankind, laying aside all the garbage and all the beef wash. You know what I meant by that? I didn't say hogwash. Right? Because what I find that God has in store for us is rather incredible. Now, to go any farther, I've got something up here. What do you think these are? I don't know what they are. Yes, we have an intelligent group here. That's true. I appreciate you saying that. These really are two what I call dowel rods. Are these not dowel rods? Okay, but forget them being dowel rods, all right? They're not dowel rods. They're supposed to be something else, all right? Skiing sticks, all right? That's a good... Now, one man told me that he thought these were props for eyelids. We have a lot of imagination in the church. Now, the reason why I want you to guess what these are is because I was given a little bit of a challenge about 2 or 3 weeks ago to solve a problem. And I want us to solve the problem together. And it involves these two sticks. Now, you're going to have to use your imagination, all right? But the reason why these are 3 feet long is because that's the way the story was presented to me. These are 3 feet long. And what we've got to do is imagine, all right, I'm going to draw on your imagination. These are you ready for this? These are chopsticks. All right? These are chopsticks. Can you believe that? Now, the Jacques... Raymond Jacques, you know, I should have known he'd figure this out. I know, was it you that figured it? Was your brother who figured it out? He said, you know, now let me give you the problem first, all right? The problem here is, if you've got 3 feet long chopsticks, how do you feed yourself? Okay? Do you see the problem? Now, of course, one of the Jacques said, well, the way you do it, you just slide your hand down. You know, you slide your hand down and, you know, just bring... You do it like this. All right. You can't do that. That's not allowed. All right. Let's rule that out. They can't do that. The way you've got to solve this problem, I'm going to show you the problem. And the reason why I'm doing this is I needed a visual aid to demonstrate this. Otherwise, when I tell you how I'm going to conclude the sermon, you wouldn't have got it because I didn't get it. Well, you may have gotten it, even though I didn't. I don't mean to say that. You've got to hold the chopsticks like this. Okay? Do you see the problem? I mean, you know, you can get them into a bowl. Okay, let's give yourself the benefit of the doubt, and you get them into the bowl, all right? Okay, and so you've got 2 pieces of rice on this. Right? The problem is, okay, how do you get it into your mouth? You see the problem? How do you do it? It's a genuine problem. All right, we're going to solve that problem before we're through here this morning. All part of the sermon. First of all, then, I would like for us to focus in on what I've already said to you. And that's this never-ending story, which is a fun story. It's something that I look forward to and anticipate and hope you do, too. And if the kids are listening today, please pay special attention because I hope it'll have some meaning for you. This world we live in is a story that I want to change, and I hope you want it to change, too. I'm tired of seeing all the misery and the unhappiness and the sickness and the disease. You know, I'm really sorry about Rock Hudson. I don't know if all of you know that or not, but he died yesterday, I believe it was, and died of it. You know, I'm sorry about that. You know, I know the penalty for sin, but that's an awful way to die. And if any of you have seen how much he changed from one, even a year ago, it's just absolutely pathetic. I'm tired of nursing homes. You know, my grandfather, before he died, was in a nursing home just because we couldn't physically. You know, I'm tired of that. There was a lady in that nursing home. You would just walk by her, and it would just tear your heart out. She was sitting there. She didn't even know where she was, and she was very, very much overweight, and her mouth was open, and she just gibberish, and just such a pathetic, pathetic sight. I'm tired of that story. I'm tired of war. I'm tired of the pictures of people dying. And the little children with starvation and all the diseases that they have and the flies, you know, on and all that kind of thing. I want that story to end and another one to replace it. I understand there was a movie that's come out called A Neverending Story. Is that true? I've not seen it, but I've been told that it's a children's story, but it's fairly entertaining and enjoyable. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Like I said, I've not seen it. But to take off from that, I'd like to tell you what I perceive as a never-ending story for us today. It's a story that is happy, it's filled with joy, it's something for all of us to look forward to. And yet there's a direct, don't lose sight of it, significant point to how it's going to all tie together before I'm through. I want to, in this never-ending story, give it four chapters. Right? Chapter number one is entitled, if I may caption it, A Fun Tomorrow. A Fun Tomorrow. It's something to look forward to when tomorrow is going to be fun. One of the things that's going to make tomorrow fun is we have to believe the impossible. We have to believe the impossible. Now, there are two types of impossible. I was introduced to some of Dr. Schuller's material. All of you familiar with Dr. Schuller, the cathedral building, the glass cathedral building out there in California? And years ago, I read some of his books, some of his material, and I found it interesting. But then there are some things in there that I just, it drew too much on my mind. I just couldn't accept it. Now, one of the things which he said in there is to believe the impossible. And I like that, but only in context of what's reinforced substantially by the Word of God. See, I don't want to believe things that really aren't possible. And there are some things that are not possible, are there not? Now, let me tell you how he developed his thought. He said, number one, he says, do you think that you could ever see the sun rise in the east? I'm sorry, that's not correct. That's the way it always rises. That's not impossible. The way it was, he said, do you think you can ever see the sun rise in the west? Now, come on. You're not thinking the impossible. Think the impossible. All right, so we're sitting there thinking. Okay, I'm going to see the sun rise in the west. North, south, I'm not crossing. North, south, east, west. See the sun rise in the west. Is that impossible? It's not impossible. Did you know that? Do you know how you can see the sun rise? And I'm not talking about going to Alaska. You can see the sun rise in the west. I'm going to get it right. Yeah, in the west. Do you know how you do it? That's right. You buy yourself a ticket on the Concorde. You know what the Concorde is? It's an airplane that flies at a phenomenal speed. Right? And guess what can happen? It flies so fast that if you're flying west, you catch up to the sun. And you see then, because you're catching up to the sun, you see the sun rise in the west. You didn't know that, did you? Of course, it's really important, too, but... you see what he said? Think the impossible. The other thing he said that he did, and I don't remember because I just was recalling some of these things to mind. He said that he had I guess he was building a basement or doing something and said he had to get a backhoe and get his basement dug out. I mean, he was in one home, but he was doing something else. And so he said he had to think the impossible. So you know what he did? He tells a story. He just thought the impossible. That someone would come along with a backhoe and dig a hole. So as I remember the story, he went out and he stood on his sidewalk there. And he was thinking the impossible. And so guess what happened? Somebody with a backhoe came along. That's right. And they dug the hole for him. Now, I have a little trouble with that, to think the impossible. I need some firewood at home. I do. I've got our home has several fireplaces in it, and I need a load of firewood. Now, think the impossible with me, and let's be realistic, have a little fun with it, because this is a little bit of what this message is, to have some fun, too. Do you think that if I stand on my sidewalk in Salt Lake City when I get back and think firewood, if somebody's going to offer me some? Well, I mean, if I put a sign on, I'm thinking firewood, that might work. But I have a problem with that because I don't... See, the other one was physical gimmickry, you know, getting in a physical airplane and catching up. So I'm not talking now about gimmickry. I'm talking about a matter of faith. You see, he says, have enough faith to believe the impossible. Well, we do have enough faith, and I'm going to show you that you do have enough faith that you do believe the impossible, because that's part of a fun tomorrow. But for me to do this, to go back home to Salt Lake City and stand there on the sidewalk and wish for firewood, I don't think... Do you want me to try it? And if I have a chance to see you next year, you know, to tell you how it worked? How long do you want me to stand out there? Now, I've got to go to work. So I can't stand out for more than... If it's a nice day, I might give you 2 hours. You want me to do it? And just think the impossible? There'll probably be a write-up in the local newspaper. Insane minister stands on side hoping for impossible. I don't know. I just don't think that. I think I could stand there until winter froze over and me part of it, nobody would help me. And maybe say, there's a poor frozen fool, let's go help him. So I have trouble with that line of reasoning, although the thing I want to get to is that God does want us to believe in a fun tomorrow, and to do that, you've got to think the impossible. All right, let me illustrate that to you. Let's turn over here to Isaiah 35, which is a fun chapter. I'll hurry along here. Isaiah 35, this is one of my favorite verses at the Feast of Tabernacles. Has this one been read so far at the feast yet? I don't want to be redundant and step on anybody's material, but this one, if it hasn't been read, I'd like to read it to you because it's a lot of fun. And especially for the kids as well as the adults. It says, "The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose." Now, I live right in the Great Salt Lake area, and there's a great, big, huge desert out there that's absolutely, as far as I know, worthless, except for a little bit of salt that can be derived from it, and they run the races out there, and they fly over it and all that kind of thing. But basically, it wouldn't grow anything. But one of these days, that desert, I believe, will blossom forth as a rose. And what a dramatic difference that's going to be. You know, up here in these mountains, you have the gorgeous rhododendrons and the mountain laurel, those types of flowers which have already bloomed and, you know, died by now. It's just fabulously beautiful to be in the mountains and up in the trees in the forest when they're in bloom. You know, smell them and all that kind of thing. And I personally enjoy flowers. Everybody here enjoy flowers all right? I was talking about this, and I was worried about, you know, this macho image. You know, you're going to be macho, you can't like flowers. But I guess, you know, it depends on your interpretation of macho. I personally like to get up in the morning, and we have roses on one side of our house, and to get out, take my daughters with me, or late in the evening after we've gone and picked squash out of the garden, and go over there and see how the flowers are blooming. You know, and you get in there and you smell it and all that kind of thing, and the girls reaching up, and we try to determine which rose has the most aroma. You know, we've got yellow ones and pink ones and rich red ones and velvet ones and all these kinds. And it's just sort of enjoyable. I can't wait, can you? Until one of these days the desert blossoms forth with flowers and with roses, if you will, in this analogy. It shall blossom abundantly. Okay. Can you imagine how beautiful that's going to be? Just, we have an abundance of trees here. Look how gorgeous this is. Just wait until the deserts are blossoming forth. All right. Let's go on here. Something it says here in verse 4. "Say to them that are of a fearful heart." And I like to talk about this verse as to who do you think the Feast of Tabernacles in its fulfillment means the most to? Would you think? It means a lot to you and to me. But I tend to think it means a lot to people who, as it says here in verse 5, are blind. Can't see. And one of these days are going to see. And also those that can't hear, and the deaf are going to hear one day. And those, as it says here, the lame man's going to leap as a hart. What an exciting time that's going to be. I think the Feast of Tabernacles, in its fulfillment, physically talking to people who are lame and can't hear or blind or whatever it might be, these verses have to be so encouraging that you've got to have faith to believe what is presently impossible. Right? in the sense that I have never known or seen, we get tangled up here, a man who did not have an arm have his arm grow back. Have you? See, we wrestle. Well, we've seen people that have been healed of blindness. We know of people who got their hearing back, and that's wonderful. But I'm telling you, I don't know that I have ever yet seen nor met anyone who had a withered leg, and all of a sudden they were anointed, and one day, the next day, whenever it was, they woke up, and their leg was no longer withered. Do you? So what I'm saying is these verses challenge my faith to believe what presently is impossible. Right? It's part of the fun tomorrow. It goes on to say this, the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of waters. It goes on to talk then about the fulfillment here in verse 9. No lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast shall go up thereon. And that's really fascinating to think about. You have to have faith in the impossible to believe that there's going to be a time when you can wander in these woods, although I don't believe there are any more black bear up here, are there? Any more black bear in these woods? Well, I heard there were about four or five on the loose. No, I didn't hear that. But if you and I knew that there were four or five black bear roaming around up here, do you think that would change what you do late at night? The other day, I took a sort of a late afternoon walk through the woods. And I got a hunch, if I knew that there were four or five bear roaming around up here, that I probably would have gone in the car. You know, because I like to live. I'm not interested in become bear bait. I'm not interested in that. I believe that one day, lions aren't going to maim us or our children. But I have to believe the impossible. Because right now, they will. Now, I have a little kitty at home, which to me, I just didn't get rid of. And I don't mean to step on anybody's feelings here. Let me take a quick survey of this part of the country. How many of this part of the country from the, you know, wherever we're all from, how many of you have cats as pets? We have some sick and diseased people in our church. How many? I have one too, so I'm including myself. How many of you have dogs? How many of you have dogs and cats? Oh, you're really asking for trouble there. All right, I've got this little cat at home whose nature I would like to change. Do you want to change yours nature? And I have a dog that I don't want to change. She's okay. But my cat, I'd like to change her nature. It's not even a she, it's an it right now. It's an it. And I guess I'd be cranky too if I was an it. But what'll happen is it's one of these tiger cats. Do you know what I mean by a tiger cat? And my little gal is four and a half years old now. So she wants to play with this cat all the time. And this cat will be laying there, snoozing away, up on its back, sort of curled up like they do. My little girl, it's an open invitation, you know, to pet her belly, to pet its belly. So my little girl will go down there and just with glee, you know, and excitement, she'll reach out. And you know what the cat does? Water. And of course, my girl really thinks that's fun. Oh, that's fun. Laughs and carries on, all that kind of thing. And then the next thing you know, though, the cat, she peels those ears back. It peels those ears back. And I have no love for this cat. I want you to know that right now. And that cat knows it. I believe it knows it because in the morning, see, I don't even want to have anything to do with this critter. And I'm not an animal hater, by the way. I do like some cats. I think I do. I don't know. I've never had a cat that I liked yet. But you know the reason why I don't like a cat? I'll tell you honestly why I don't like a cat. Because I'll say, here, kitty, 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 kitty. And it won't come. That's, or you know, unless you got milk or food or something to a reward, then it comes. Well, my dog, I'll say, Serena, if any of your name's Serena, don't let that hurt you. But my dog's name is Serena. You probably have some dogs you name Gross, too. That's all right. I'll say, Serena, Serena, and I just my voice. She'll, you know, come on over. Or, Serena, I'll say, go see Tanya. She plods over. To the cat, Tiger, I say, Tiger, go outside. Thing runs upstairs and hides. And in the morning, I have a water bed. I sleep on a water bed. And when the cat is let in, guess where the cat comes? I hate this cat. This cat comes and lays with me. you know. And I'll wake up and that cat will be staring me eyeball to eyeball. I hate it. And the reason why I like it is because the cat won't do what I want it to do. It won't perform. It won't come through. See, so I've got to believe the impossible, that one day that cat's nature is going to be changed. Now, we may have already contributed to that change in having it neutered, you know. It has probably you have a right to feel that way when that's happened to you, I guess. But one of these days, the Bible talks about lions and, you know, even sharks. You know, we're going to have, today we don't have a shark Sabbath. There's no such thing. Because sharks are always out there, we think. One of these days, sharks probably, you know, aren't going to bother you, you know. I've got a friendly shark here. Let me, this is my shark. You got one? You know, have some fun with it if you live on the beach. Well, these verses here talk about a fun tomorrow. And I'll tell you what, parents, have some fun with your kids and tell them about tomorrow, that it's a fun tomorrow. And yet I realize it's going to tax them just a little bit because they're going to have to believe in what presently is impossible. All right, let's go on to the second chapter. I'm going to have to hurry along here. To the second chapter of my never-ending story, which I think is going to be wonderful for all eternity. And I've entitled this Star Peace. Star Peace, not Star Wars. We've had enough war in the stars, don't you think? From who knows how long, predating the creation of man. The pockmarked moon, the different planets, the stars, all the confusion that exists there, our very Earth. And yet now we're looking at putting up satellites around the Earth. I understand Ronald Reagan's reasons for doing it, and I understand why the Russians want us not to do it and all this kind of thing. But Gorbachev stated it perhaps correctly. He said he's more interested in Star Peace, whether or not we can believe that, we don't know or not. He wants Star Peace rather than Star Wars. Guess what? So do I. I want Star Peace. I'd like for you to see that over in Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2. It's a part of a fun tomorrow, if you will. That's also captioned now, chapter 2, Star Peace. You know, your children and you can stand out on a beautiful starlit evening and look up at the stars, and you can talk to your children. You can't now because it's cloudy, but you can look up at the stars and talk to your children and tell them about, if you know, constellations or the North Star or the black voidness in the northern hemisphere, and talk about these things and just let them know about tomorrow and about peace and not worrying about God and Jesus Christ, creation, to instill in their mind the very existence of God. You know, I was talking with a man recently, in all sincerity. We met at the Sheridan for breakfast and we were sitting there talking. He was interested in talking about the church. We were having a very good discussion. We were talking about things like heaven and hell. We were talking about things like the Trinity. We were talking about things like the Holy Days. And all of a sudden, we got into this conversation about, do you believe that God is creator? And this is something that we probably all solved a long, long time ago. And in this conversation, I could see that there was something here that I hadn't detected yet. And I said, well, listen, I said, personally, I look out at all this, that, and the other thing, and I look at the explanations of why evolution has succeeded, and it's a bunch of foolishness to me. And I'll say, I don't believe it. I believe in the Creator God. He says, well, that takes faith. I said, well, probably it does. I said, what do you believe in? He says, I believe in evolution. I said, you do? And then I was saying, why are we just talking about all this thing with God if this man believes in evolution? I said, well, what do you think? He said, well, you know the Big Bang Theory? And he told me a little bit about that, which we had discussed in college and studied. And finally, his conclusion, I said, now listen, I want you to tell me something. I said, I believe that one day God knelt down in a group, in a bunch of red dirt, if you will, Tennessee dirt. It wasn't Tennessee dirt. But anyway, he took dirt in his hand and he molded and he shaped and he fashioned, if you will, me and you, Adam and Eve. He said, well, that's hard to believe. And I said, well, okay, I'll accept that. I said, what do you believe? He says, I believe that I came from an amoeba. I looked at him and you do? And I said, no, I said, I don't want to hurt your feelings. I said, but you say that it takes faith for me to believe that I came from a creator God. I said, do you know how much faith it takes for me to believe that you came from an amoeba? And I said, listen, I said, if you want to think that you came from an amoeba, you go right ahead. I said, I did not come from an amoeba. I just didn't. I'm sorry. You know, I just didn't. You know, I've been called things like that, you know, slime and all that kind of thing, but I really didn't come from an amoeba. And neither did you. Now, we can look at what's going on around us and talk and enjoy all that God has given to us and realize what it says here in Isaiah 2 is going to become a part of tomorrow. And it will eventually be permanent. It'll be a permanent part of that never, never ending story. And it won't be accomplished, as far as I can see, until the latter end of the millennium. Finally, then, after Satan is through and he's released, there'll be no more war. Now, let's see what it says here, just to be reminded. Many people, verse 4, shall go up and say, come you and let us go up to the mountain, probably here in Banner Elk. No, we're up on the mountain here, of the eternal, to the house of God, the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the eternal from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among the nations and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. How many of you men, address the men, because this is an inward yearning that I have. I don't know if it's because of my upbringing, but you know what I would really like to do? If I could choose my job, my occupation, I would like to be a farmer. Do any of you men share that desire? Be a farmer? I would like to be a farmer. How many of you men would like to be farmers? Okay. Now, what I don't understand is why the rest of you don't. That's because you are farmers. that has to be the reason. See, once you're that, you don't want to ever be it again. I guess that's what it is. The reason why, and I'm not talking about it from the from living, surviving commercially. I'm talking about it just from the viewpoint of the way I see it having been done in my family background. Where we lived up in the mountains, and you know, it wasn't important to have the latest car. And it wasn't important to have the nicest house. You know, I grew up in a house where we didn't have carpet. I grew up in a house where, guess where we went to potty? See you later, we gotta go outside. Really tough in the winter, I'm here to tell you. You know, we grew up to where we got, you know how we got our desserts? We went out and picked the blackberries. That's how we did it. We came back in, hey, I've helped can blackberries, and I've helped eat a great deal of them too, you know. I remember how we used to get our fish. I used to go down to Dale Hollow Reservoir, and guess what we'd do? We'd catch them. If I wanted to go somewhere, I didn't have to have a car, I walked. See? I used to get in the tobacco fields, and of course I don't want to grow tobacco necessarily, but, you know, get behind an old mule and plant them and do all the things you have to do. And I looked at that life, I used to pick peppers, all these types of things, and there was something good about it. Really good about it. Not only did you enjoy the fruit of your labor, literally, by eating it, but you know, you came home at night, my word, I didn't have any trouble going to sleep. I didn't need to watch Johnny Carson to go to sleep. You know, just get me fed, and I'm gone. Had a big feather bed. You've heard John Denver sing. We had a great big old feather bed. Great big old feather bed. I used to love that feather bed. Just fantastic. So these are the things I have in my mind, and I see a little bit of that coming up in the world tomorrow, where farming won't have to worry about prices necessarily, because it'll be a great deal of barter. See, you've got sheep, I've got turkeys. By the way, if you ever have grasshoppers and you want to get rid of them, what do you get? Turkeys. You learn great things at church if you only knew that. All right, let's go on here. It says, they shall learn war, not anymore. No more war. Start peace. Boy, I can't wait. I just can't wait for that to happen. Let's go on quickly here to the third chapter of my never-ending story. And I just want to, as you're thinking and going along with me here, just a little final thought. You know, if shedding our blood, that's what war is all about, if shedding our blood makes us enemies, then let's hope that sharing our tears can make us brothers. And that's the reason why when I see what happened in Mexico and what I see happening in Beirut or wherever it might be, it really pulls at me, and I have a sense of kinship to these people. I hate to see the suffering. And there's a lot of suffering ahead of us, and perhaps there will be a real gathering together eventually, and certainly it will be that way, as we experience no longer war, but the results of war, and ultimately being able to share our lives together and become brothers and sisters regardless. Let's go to chapter 3. I've entitled that, Truthfully Yours. Truthfully Yours. Never-ending story. And I'm going to lay a lot of responsibility here at the feet of ministers, including myself. Let's come over here to Jeremiah chapter 12. I want you to see something there. Jeremiah chapter 12. I yearn for, look forward to, anticipate, and want so desperately a never-ending story, a world tomorrow where everybody tells the truth. It is so easy to lie today. So easy to distort. So easy to fabricate. And as a result, people's lives are ruined by the subtlety of lying and deceitfulness. And the ones I'm putting at the top of the list are ministers. Notice what it says here in Jeremiah chapter 12, over here in verse 10. I'm really breaking into a thought, but notice what it says. It says, many pastors have destroyed my vineyard. They have trodden my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness. I tire of the bombardment of material, either in written form or on the television set, that you and I are subjected to by ministers, if you will, who are telling you nothing more than a little truth and a lot of lie. That's one reason why I really enjoy Ted Armstrong being on television. Sometimes he's on two times or one time. In my area, he's on certainly one time. But I can turn on the television set. I'm not casting any stones here, and please don't take it this way, but it's just my feeling. You may not share this, and that's fine. It's just my feeling. Permit me to say this. And Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, comes on before Ted Armstrong does in Salt Lake City. And I turn Herbert Armstrong off now. I don't mean to hurt anybody's feelings. And I love Mr. Armstrong. I love Herbert W. Armstrong. I think I do anyway. But you know why I turn him off now? I'll listen to him sometimes, but finally he'll come to something where I know he's not telling it like it is. I'm not saying he's lying, but I'm saying he's doing like every other minister is doing, and he's giving you the bait with a barb. I'm tired of you beautiful women being beaten and bartered, I mean, just battered, and I'm tired of it, you know. I'm tired of it. I don't want to hear that. I want to turn it off, you know. I want to hear about government, God's government, but I don't want to hear about the wrong kind of government. So I have to tell you that not only do I turn off many of the other religious broadcasters now, and like you, I listen to some of them until all of a sudden I'm up to here and I can't stand it anymore. But I've also, unfortunately, included a man I never thought I would do that to. And I listen to Ted Armstrong because guess what I've learned? He gets on there and he's telling me the truth. And you know, all I want is the truth. That's all I want. Just tell me the truth. There are some things in the Bible I'm not just intelligent enough to figure out. So somebody else who knows the truth, just tell me the truth. Don't cloud it in propaganda. Don't mesh it in deceit. Just tell me the truth. I can't wait until tomorrow, if you will, when it's a never-ending story and it's all the truth. Won't that be beautiful? Today, ministers get up here and you can see them all. And if you can sing loud, and if you can get emotional and really beat and pound the Bible and wipe sweat off and throw it in the audience and really get emotional and sing, you're a minister. And yet people don't seem to listen to the message. Well, I hope people will begin to listen to the message. And one of these days, myself included, I'm sure I'm going to have to learn more truth. I'm sure I'm going to have to get before Jesus Christ and just apologize. When I think of some of the things that I have said, oh, shame, shame, shame. You know, God forgive me, and God's people forgive me as well. Now, a wonderful tomorrow where it will be truthfully yours. Now, let me just illustrate my point, because you all are going to agree with this. Do we have in this audience a converted used car salesman? See, I put pastors number one, but guess who's number two? Well, politicians are number two, really. And I put used car salesman number three. I would like to have honest politicians, too, somebody who would tell me the truth. Because you know how politicians are. I mean, literally, it's just so true. They tell you something and they'll do the exact so it seems opposite. If they tell you you're not going to raise your taxes, guess what happens? Pull out your wallet because here it comes. But to illustrate my point, because you'll all identify with this, how many of you own a used car? I do. All right. Well, if you're embarrassed, that's all right. Don't have to raise your hand. But we don't have in this congregation one used car salesman. We've got one. We do. Are you really a used car salesman? God is still working miracles. There's no question about it. Now, the reason why I say that is, you're like me, you're in an occupation that has a bad reputation. To be a minister is just, you know. They did a survey several years ago, this will make you feel better. They did a survey years ago of the least desired occupations. Do you know what was number one? A minister. Do you know what was number two? No, a mortician. So as a minister, I felt a little bit better. I was slightly, you know, just a notch above a mortician. But used car salesmen were on there too. But I'm glad to hear we've got... Now, anybody who needs a used car, this man here will tell you the truth. Right? Or you won't sell a car. Would you leave your name, address, and phone number with me after church? I'd like to get a hold of you. Now, I illustrate that point because isn't it true none of us believe that there is such a thing as an honest used car salesman, do we? Right? Do you realize there's a wonderful world tomorrow where we're running around in cars or chariots or mules that everybody's going to be honest? Wonderful, truthfully yours world tomorrow. All right, let's go on quickly. I guess there are so many things we can say. Now, one other thing I want to mention here in this point, truthfully yours, I'm talking about Ted Armstrong and the Church of God International. Don't lose, brethren, the significance of what this church is accomplishing. We've had a whole year to grow and to sit and watch and experience. And I'm going to be frank with you about an observation of mine because I've gone from church to church and been a speaker at different churches. And there's one thing that bothers me. And I don't know what to do about it. And if you all have an answer, please give it to me because I'm trying to find the answer. Let me tell you what the problem is. I see people gathering together in church, meeting together, getting off on a great deal of excitement and zeal and camaraderie and sharing together and fun and potlucks and, you know, and doing things. And then all of a sudden it seems like it just falls apart for some reason. Now, I ran into a person here recently, not literally ran into them, I was talking to them. And I said, well, listen, I was at such and such a city a couple Sabbaths ago and I was preaching there. I had a chance to be a guest preacher. And I said, I didn't see you there. And the person's comment said was, well, I wasn't there. And I said, well, you weren't there. I said, you know, I didn't know, should I ask anything else or just what? And this person was nice enough to say, well, let me just explain. She said, we don't meet with those people anymore. And that saddened me. And I said, these people keep the Sabbath, they keep the holy days, and you know they're God's people, and you don't meet with them? And the comment was basically, no, we don't, because we have a problem with some of the people. We have a problem with some of the people. And I thought, so I didn't say anything because I don't want to step on anybody's toes. But that bothers me. You see, that bothers me a little bit because if we're going to let people stand in the way of what this is all about, we don't have a chance, brethren. Because guess what we all are? Some of us are used car salesmen. Some of us are ministers. Whatever's insurance, we're all people, aren't we? Don't lose sight of what this church is all about and what's going on. Let me give you a story to illustrate this, all right? This is just an analogy, but it illustrates the point. Because I happen to think, and I hope you share it with me, that what Ted Armstrong and Ronald Dart are accomplishing is absolutely, I will use the term, miraculous. Because they're still being a part of converting human beings' lives. I know God does it, but they're the vessel. Mr. Dart, Mr. Armstrong come up with some unbelievable material. Things like, I feel like I'm growing up again all over. I really do. Because of the truth they're coming to and the approach they take. All right, here's the story. There was a farmer who had a neighbor farmer. And the one farmer was very positive, very optimistic. You know, he would look at the showers and say, well, it's going to rain and give us... moisture for our crops. The other one said, oh, it's probably going to rain and be a gully washer and wash us out. Right? So the fellow who was optimistic decided, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my neighbor honey, duck honey. And so the optimistic farmer had a bird dog that he had never taken bird dogging before, duck hunting. So he took him out there, and sure enough, they were out there, and guess what happened? A duck flew up, and both farmers are there, and he shoots that duck, and the duck falls down, falls right in the pool of water. And the dog runs out to get the duck, walks on the water. Walks on the water. And, of course, the optimistic farmer said, I don't believe it. Do you see that? And he looks over at the other guy and he says, did you see that? And the guy said, yeah, I sure did. He said, didn't you see anything unusual? The guy said, well, he looks like just any other bird dog I've ever seen. So then the guy says, I can't believe it.
You know, so guess what happened? They got him lined up again. Another duck threw up, shot another duck. The duck goes in the water. And he sends the dog after it. And this time, the dog goes out and walks on the water again. Right in full view of both men. And this man, he can't believe it. See? He's all excited. And the dog comes back and says, "Now, did you see anything happen that time that was out of the ordinary?" I said, "No, all I can see is that that dog can't swim." All right. The reason I mention that is because, I know it's sort of entertaining, but the man, because of his attitude, he missed the miracle. Do you see what I'm saying? He saw it, but he really didn't see it. He missed the miracle. And let's not let that happen to us in God's church, brethren. The miracle of what's happening through human beings. That's apparently been repeated time and time again. Through human vessels like you and me and you and you and you. And even the used car salesman. I'm just having fun. I'll have to talk to you later. Much later, that's what he'll say. Let's not miss the miracle of what's happening, okay, in this group, the Church of God International, as well as other of God's bodies. I realize that. All right, let's go along very quickly here to the final point, and that is my fourth chapter, which I have called Spirited Life. Spirited Life, which is a never-ending story. It's exciting, and I don't want it to ever stop. And I'd like to illustrate it with husbands and wives to begin with. That is, I believe, as was mentioned in the sermonette by Mr. Magnum, Mr. Mangum, Mr. Rader, no. I believe what he said in that God has given us His Holy Spirit, and it's something that helps, right? I believe that God expects us as His people to have godly answers to human problems. And that's part of the reason why I've got this, right? Godly answers. But you help me out here just a little bit. Let's go, first of all, to a story about Job. I don't have time to turn there. Just follow along with me. Have you ever thought about the situation with Job? There's one thing about the story of Job that's always partially bothered me. You know what that is? Who was the biggest thorn in the flesh to Job? His wife. Have you ever wondered why Satan spared her? I don't like the thought either, but let's face the facts. Wasn't Satan the one who was doing all of this? Have you ever noticed that Satan took everybody except her? And guess what she was? She was part of the problem. Because what was her advice to poor old Job, who's sitting there with boils and lost all of his family and his home and his animals and his sheep and everything? What was her advice? "Listen, Job, I got a good advice. Here's the advice. Curse God and get it over with. And die." And I'm sitting here thinking, now who needs advice like that at a time like that? Do you know there's one other place in the Bible where she's quoted? You know what is said about her? I quote, quoting Job, "My breath is strange to my wife." What a marriage. Now, husbands, think for a moment. If the only thing you have to say in entirety of how many chapters, 38, 42 chapters in Job, whatever it is there, the only thing you have to say about your wife is, "My wife thinks that my breath does not smell good." I tell you, your marriage needs help. You can check it out. That's what it says. So I look at the situation, I think about poor Job, and I don't have the answer. I just wish that Mrs. Job had been a little bit different, perhaps. Now, let's go ahead. I want to give you some solutions, some problems. I want you to solve them, okay? All right. You're God's people. We're seeking godly answers to human problems. All right. I'm going a little bit over time. I apologize for that. If you have to go, it'll hurt my feelings. No, it won't hurt my feelings. All right, here it is. You are married to a wife who will not dust the furniture. I mean, she just won't do it. There's one. All right, let's change it. Let's make it a big deal. All right? She has not dusted for years. All right? And so now the furniture, you know, You to sit down on the sofa, you come in with a small shovel, you know, and you get it out of the way, all right? All right, what I'm after here are solutions, okay? I'm after solutions. Because we are to live a spirit of life. And this life involves God's people having answers, not running from problems. All right, so just think a little bit. Your wife will not dust the furniture. Now, some women would say, well, listen, Buster, if you want the furniture dusted, you've got a right hand, you go dust it yourself. All right? That's one solution. All right? Another solution is, what difference does it make? All right? I grant you that, too. But I like the one that actually occurred, because this is a true story. Because the husband really did love the wife, and the wife really did love the husband, but he was fastidious. He was a little bit, you know, he liked things clean. So you know what he did? He had talked with his wife and said, sweetheart, I know, just come up with, here's the solution. Just do it, okay? And so one morning he got up to go to work, and he walked into the living room, and the coffee table had not been dusted at all. You know what he did? He took his finger, and he wrote, I love you, in the dust. And do you know what happened? She never had a problem again. So, don't you think that's a little bit of a creative way to go about it? I like that answer, don't you? So, when we get back home, let's all start sending little messages to each other. That's and instead of fighting it out and being carnal, why can't we be creative with God's Holy Spirit and the Spirit of life to find happy solutions to what are maybe major problems and minor problems, all right? I want to tell you another story. And this one is much more serious. And this is true. This was a young couple. And you know, when you're younger, this is, I think, true. You know, kissing and those kinds of things are a whole lot more important than when you're older. Is that true? I'm not going to give away my age here. But what I'm talking about, I'm in a real mess on this thing. I can see that right now. What I'm talking about is still important, okay? But perhaps it's more important when you're younger than it is when you're over. When you're Mr. Fitz's age. I'll never be invited to speak again. I can see it all right now. If we can't have a little bit of fun, you know, there's no stone casting. But all right, did you get my point? But this is the true story. They were a young couple, and they were deeply in love, and she had developed a tumor in her cheek, And the only way to get rid of it was to, you know, to take it out of here. And in so doing, the doctor who performed the operation knew that he would have to cut one of the nerves to the mouth, which is critical to holding the our mouths in the shape that they're in. Right? So what happened is he went ahead and performed the operation, and sure enough, after the operation was over and they were both in there together, you can imagine the situation. What is the problem here? The problem is, if you were the woman, what would you be worried about? You'd be worried about not only your looks, but you'd be worried about what your husband, if you love your husband, you're going to be worried about what your husband thinks. Right? I like what he did. The doctor took off the bandages, and sure enough, she was slightly disfigured. And the corner of her mouth was not what it had been. So the young man, going up to his wife, first asked the doctor, and said, will I always be like this? The doctor said, yes, you will. So now the husband came up, and he looked at her, and he said, I think it's sort of cute. And he reached over and bent down, and he twisted his lips with his mouth muscles to the shape of hers and gave her a kiss to show her that their kiss still worked. A creative solution to perhaps a sensitive problem, don't you think? Boy, I like that. That's spirited life. That's fantastic. That's enjoyable. Why don't you help me solve this problem? Okay? All right, let me go back and set the story for you again. And this comes down to what I was talking about before about why, you know, please bear with me, brethren. Can't we get along? Can't we have the spirit of life together? Can't we just stop letting people get in the way of what? Don't miss the miracle. Don't look at the dog, if you will, and say, well, he can't swim. Catch the miracle and the significance of it. All right, here's my story. Chopsticks, 3 feet long. We've got to feed ourselves, right? The story is completely hypothetical. It involves a young man who was basically good all of his life. Right? And he died and he went to heaven. He got up to heaven, and there at the pearly gates, he didn't go into heaven, he was just up to heaven. Right? He got up to heaven, and he was there at the gates, and whoever's there, Peter, he's normally at the gate, right? I wonder why Andrew's never there. I don't know, but it's always Peter. All right, so he's standing there, and he said, you know, this is heaven and all that, and I'm excited to go in, but I'm really curious because I've lived such a good life. I'm wondering what life is like in hell. And so he said, well, Peter, do you think you can arrange for me to go down to hell for a while? Just make sure I come back. So he said, sure, I think it could be arranged. And he arranged it, and so this young man went down to hell. When he got to hell, I don't know who was there, Satan was there, whoever was there. And he looked around, and everybody was there. And he said there was all the food and the beauty and all the wonderful things that he hadn't expected. He said, but there was a difference. He said everybody there had chopsticks 3 feet long. And they were starving to death. They were starving to death. They were gaunt. They were lifeless. They were in agony. They were crying out in hunger. They were starving to death. And the young man observed with the fellow. He says, well, you know, everything's here. All the food's here. Everything's here. But they're starving to death. And then and he said, yeah. And he said, that's the hell of it. Right? Now, that's the way the story was told to me, right? So next, he goes back to heaven. He goes up to heaven. And he hasn't been in there, right? He hasn't been. So he goes into heaven, and guess what he finds? He finds beauty and glory and all that. And he finds the same situation. He finds a lot of people. And he finds all this food. And he notices that everybody there has 3-foot-long chopsticks, too. The difference is, they were feeding each other. Do you get the point? They were feeding each other. I hope in God's church, brethren, that we can learn from that little story. And I hope that we're not allowing our brethren, our friends, our relatives, ourselves to starve, if you will, because we have not yet learned how to feed and care for each other. We have each other. We have our beliefs. We have our trusts. We have our confidences. I really question the wisdom of all of us who can be as cynical schoolmasters and can look with prejudgment upon a world filled with violence and condemn the violence and all that we foresee. Yes, we should do that, but shouldn't we rather, on the other hand, be filled with a little bit of compassion and embrace the sufferings of our brethren and mankind? Reaching out to each other, as Mr. Armstrong was talking about, I hope we can. We need each other as those who live God's way. We do. I think it might be fitting for us to begin with each other today. Or at least resolve not to give up on each other today. We've come here to live a happy story. A story that's never ending. A happy story. We want to live happily ever after, don't we? We are living a life that has a happy ending. And that's my never-ending story.